Welcome to a mini-series of Neurosalience, featuring interviews with some of this year's annual meeting's keynote speakers.
So perhaps we can start with the last question on the list, because I guess that is the most interesting for most of us, since we didn't get to see many details on the website. So regarding the topic of your talk for this year's OHPM, if you could say a few words and give us some details on that. It doesn't have to be a lot if you would rather not.
So I think the topic of the talk will be something along the lines of cortical imaging, is deep learning the answer? Because, I accept that this is a really open question and potentially quite a contentious one. And it would be great to be able to initiate in a discussion along those lines. So, I mean, my personal opinion is that, you know, it's really important that we continue to develop classical methods alongside deep learning methods, because until we have deep learning methods that we might be able to trust, if we ever have deep learning methods that we all comprehensively trust, you know, in the absence of that, classical methods are vitally important for improving our understanding of the mechanistic, you know, processes beneath many aspects of clinical and cognitive neuroscience. But my team both works on the development of pushing forward the improvement of classical methods and developing, I believe, quite exciting new deep learning technology. So the talk will be a careful balance of new results derived from classical cortical surface-based processing, including topics such as investigating the development of cortical asymmetries and neuronates and the biomechanics of cortical folding, whilst also touching on the development of novel deep learning, and particularly geometric deep learning technologies for surface domains that will look at things such as generative modelling of neurodevelopment, so that we can potentially build biomarkers that would allow us to predict outcomes of preterm babies, physics-informed biomechanical models of Alzheimer's, surface vision transformers for precision segmentation, and cortical phenotype regression, topics along those lines. Mm-hmm. Time allowing, you know, people can express their opinions on what the balance that should be, and we'll work it out closer to time.
It will definitely be an exciting talk. I know I will be super excited, because I am also, you know, playing around a little bit with the interpretable machine learning, but just the classical approaches, since I'm more interested in practical applications and not so much in the development aspect, but more into tackling the limitations that we're currently dealing with. And since you mentioned at some point that people don't necessarily yet trust the deep learning approaches, or not uniformly, what do you think it takes for us to get there to a point of consensus with respect to their utility that we haven't achieved yet?
So fundamentally, if we're talking about clinical translation in particular, then what we need are learning-based frameworks which are accountable for their decisions. So when a clinician was wanting to rely on a machine for a diagnostic support tool, then they need to know what the reasoning is behind that decision of the machine. And so black box machine models on their own are just never going to, I think, deliver in the terms of clinical practice. So we need explainable AI models that will give us a better understanding of what the decision is. I think not just that, we also need, I think if the goal is precision diagnosis, we need to go further than just detection and towards sort of tailored simulations of macroscopic brain processes such as neurological digital twins. But, you know, in order to be able to even think about, starting to think about any of those things translating into the clinic, we need to deal with problems around concerns of bias in the networks, worries over how well they generalize to new data sets, concerns over issues such as adversarial attacks, that kind of thing. So there's lots still to work on.
This seems to be generally valid for pretty much any kind of machine learning approach that we try to translate in the clinic. It doesn't seem to me like it's very particular to deep neural networks.
True. I thought that, well, I mean, are we talking about here general methods, including classical machine learning or any approach?
Well, let's talk about your approach, the one that you are going to talk about. The generative deep learning approach, for example, the one that you talk about in your 2022 paper. Can you talk a little bit about that and how that perhaps overcomes certain limitations that we currently deal with, perhaps from other approaches?
Yeah, so I think the differences between deep learning and other classical approaches are different. So if we're talking about ICAM, which is a paper that we published in 2022, yes. The motivation for that came from many, many years working on classical image registration problems and knowing that, you know, currently we are not able to perfectly align an entire population of brain imaging data such that all features in the images completely overlap and potentially may never be able to. So image registration is itself what is called an ill-posed problem, which means that there are many possible ways of deforming any individual image to map onto another image, and that many of those possible solutions could be seen as good ones. And so in the absence of being able to explore all possible variability, we all possible options, like we impose regularization in the form of biologically informed constraints. And usually that means that we enforce our image registration algorithms to be diffeomorphic.
Yes.
And that means that if we've got an image registration, which is being defined on some grid, we don't let that grid fold and we don't let it tear.
Yes.
And the problem is that there's a huge amount of evidence now in the literature that model doesn't really represent the breadth of variability across human brains. So you see examples in the HCP cortical parcellation, for example, of instances where you would need to tear the image grid in order to perform a perfect matching. So in the absence of being able to find a solution for image registration, you know, what can you do? And deep learning is an attractive option because deep networks can be trained to be deformation or transformation invariant. So you don't need to have your data perfectly aligned. You could just, you generally start with rigidly or affirmably aligned data. But the problem, as we've already sort of touched on with deep networks, is that the early discriminative approaches of classification and regression, these are generally black box networks that give you no indication of what's driving their decision. And the other problem with like classification is that there is nothing forcing a classifier, be it a deep learning one or a classical machine learning method, to learn all features specific to some phenotype that you're trying to classify. So for example, if you were talking about Alzheimer's, and you had a population of brains with Alzheimer's disease and those with healthy, a classifier network would probably, all it would need to do is focus on differences in volume of the hippocampus and ventricles, and that would be enough to discriminate the two populations. And essentially, it can then ignore all of the cortical atrophy or the variable patterns of the heterogeneous patterns of disease of the individuals. And so these issues with the heterogeneity of disease have already been picked up by other people such as André Marcon and others who are working on normative modeling, where they highlight that there's always going to be a problem with classical approaches for comparing populations, which assume that everybody varies in the same way because diseases present heterogeneously and individual brains are highly variable. But I think the problem with many of these normative modeling approaches, as I understand them, is they're based on regression, usually Gaussian process regression, which is fitting some model of how some feature varies relative to some phenotype or variable such as age or cognitive tests. So then you're back to the problem of having to solve image registration so that you can extract those features across individuals. So the idea of ICAM is to address all these problems and generate something that's akin to a deep normative model. So it's deep learning, so it's invariant image registration, and it's generative, so it's being forced to learn all features of disease for individual brains. And it does that by explicitly disentangling those sources of disease-specific variation from the sort of vast space of natural variation of cortical appearance that would otherwise drown it out. And so essentially how it works is that it's learning all features of disease specific to an individual because it's being trained to learn how to translate an image. That if it's given an image with some disease class, for example, Alzheimer's, it needs to learn how to translate that image into one that would appear healthy sufficiently well to fool a classifier. And in order to do that, it essentially has to remove all features of disease in that image, every single one, in order to be able to fool that classifier over the process of training that network. But it's not allowed to change that image so far that it completely changes the appearance of that individual. So you can't put in an image of an Alzheimer's brain and get out a completely different brain. It has to be the same individual where you've changed its appearance to remove all features of disease. And then the difference between the simulated healthy and the ground truth disease then gives you a map of all features of disease that you can use then to track disease progression in individuals. So that's really the advantage of these deep networks. Of course, we have concerns over their generalization and bias, and rightly so, but they have this potential to build precision models that are specific to individual brains.
That sounds indeed like you are very much getting closer to achieving the desideratum of modern psychiatry in that to achieve personalized predictions. However, isn't also the appeal of interpretable machine learning approaches precisely that it kind of operates on a hierarchy of more important or more relevant features to less relevant features, and in that respect, it allows us to perform dimensionality reduction. So, for example, that might favor our ability to implement these approaches with also smaller data sets, which still is kind of an issue for some areas of neuroscience where we would not necessarily be able to achieve the best performance with a classifier if we have a very large number of features but a very limited sample size. So I can definitely see the appeal of going all the way throughout the pipeline with the maximum number of features to improve personalized prediction. But on the other hand, this seems to preclude what some approaches seem to propose as appealing and useful, in that it reduces the number of features instead of enforcing all the features being considered throughout.
Not sure entirely.
So, for example, with random forest, right? You can use random forest for dimensionality reduction. So when you run such an algorithm on a particular data set, you can look at variable importance, for example, at the end, and observe a hierarchy of importance values attached to those features. And say your sample is large enough, is in the hundreds, and you have also a feature set in the dozens, which is an okay balance. It doesn't prevent the algorithm from achieving its maximum performance. But then you would like to verify this out-of-sample performance, right, in an individual, in an independent sample. But say you don't have access to a sample that's large enough to carry on the classification using the original feature set, which would be too large to use altogether in a smaller data set. And therefore, you would go through a process of dimensionality reduction based on your initially observed importance values, right, to reduce the number of features. However, it seems that what you suggest is that it's actually better to preserve as many features as possible to individuate a particular case.
I think more the problem is that you can't always guarantee that you can extract those features accurately mm-hmm. in a hand-engineered way from individual brains. Mm-hmm. So you might say that you want to make a simplified model where your brain region. across individuals. And so often what people do is they go and they tend to use cortical folding atlases like the Desik and Kiliani or something like that. But then these atlases are based on individual brains or small populations of brains. They don't capture all the individual variability. There's a dissociation between function and folding. So actually, you know, if you're averaging properties within large folding regions, you may not be capturing individual small functional areas, and then you're averaging across lots of different imaging properties across a, you know, a range of regions, and then you lose your discriminative ability. If you're trying to extract regions, then if you don't, you're not actually accurately extracting small regions of the cortex, for example, that are functionally specific. I think the idea generally is that, you know, that with image registration, you're no longer constrained to try and hand engineer features that you don't know that you are guaranteed to be able to extract across individuals, because at the end of the day, most of these features are extracted through image registration, which is flawed. And so it's not a golden bullet, because with deep learning, you, of course, need much larger data sets. So this is why I say that I would always do both. Well, currently, I will always work on both classical methods and deep learning methods. But there's always that question of, like, how far can you push image registration? How much can you really extract, you know, individual cortical regions out across many individuals, and therefore how sensitive your features are? If you're talking about subtle features of many neuropsychiatric disorders, you know, they're tiny differences in small areas of the cortex, and they're very difficult to spot. And so the main issue is classical image processing. Essentially, you're averaging, you're looking for, you need to be hugely, highly statistically powered to see signals in these populations, because there's so much image processing noise.
I see. Well, that sounds like you had to overcome a lot of challenges throughout the development of throughout the process of developing these approaches. Can you talk a little bit about what those challenges, well, at least the most memorable, might have been, and how you overcame them? I'm asking this in the hope that it may inspire other young researchers out there who are probably also trying to tackle the big questions in the field and are feeling a little bit despondent and perhaps not being able to see any light at the end of the tunnel.
Oh, this is a difficult question. I mean, I think that whenever you're trying to develop a deep learning network to model complicated problems, you always need to be able to develop some sort of simulation or toy example, so that you can train the network, so that you know that at least you need to be able to disentangle knowing whether your model is performing how you think you've coded it up to do relative to whether actually the thing that you're looking for isn't in the data. And on also at the same time, you've always got this undercurrent of knowing whether you've got enough data, whether the data is harmonized enough, whether you've processed it the same way in order to be able to find what you're looking for. So we're endlessly going back and rerunning image processing, trying to harmonize through histogram-based matching, redoing the brain extraction to remove all of, try and further and further remove bits of the skull so it's not getting distracted on things like this. I think even with learning-based approaches, many people tend to approach it in a data agnostic way, right? They put the data in and out, they want to get something out. They're not actually always verifying and checking whether there's anything wrong with all the data that's going in and whether the results that are coming out make sense. And that's why having some level of explainable model, which is telling you what it's doing, is useful, because otherwise you're kind of working in the dark.
It makes absolute sense. And speaking of having to go through this iterative process of checking whether what comes out of your pipeline makes sense or not, and not just trusting an obscure model, how did you reach this level of knowledge? Where did you have particular mentors that were especially influential or maybe inspiring throughout your career?
Yeah, I think, you know, my research ethos was firmly grounded through a sort of interdisciplinary start to my research career. So I started by doing my PhD in medical image computing at Imperial College with Professor Daniel Rooker. But then I went to work on the Human Connectome Project, working for Mark Jenkinson and Stephen Smith at the FIMRA Centre, Oxford, on the, and during all that time, also had the great fortune to be working closely alongside really knowledgeable clinicians. So particularly thinking of Professors David Edwards and Mary Rutherford at King's College London, who are expert neonatologists, and Matt Glasser and David Van Essen in the Human Connecting Project, whom everyone knows are experts in brain anatomy. And that taught me so much, and it left me with the philosophy that, you know, I'm not afraid to try and develop, you know, push the boundaries of what can be done with methodology, but there's really no point in doing any of that if what you're developing isn't going to be practically useful for clinicians and neuroscientists. And so I think that ethos has underpinned everything that I've done so far.
Thank you. To the point that you mentioned of your working with the Human Connection Project, I also inserted a tiny question there because this has gathered a lot of attention, at least in my bubble. This larger project now that's been funded by the EU with digital twins and personalized psychiatric predictions, for example, for Alzheimer's. How do you see the potential for that to move things forward? And do you plan on getting involved with that at some point or jumping on the newer approach? How do you feel about it?
Yeah, I mean, I was not aware of that specific project until you sent it, which looks really interesting. And, you know, if they wanted me to be involved, you know, I'd be very happy to. You know, in general, I agree the future is towards neurological digital twins, but that's no easy task. So what a neurological digital twin essentially is a simulation of some macroscopic brain process. And so I know in another, you were interested in the extent to which it can be done for neuropsychiatric disorders. And the question of whether that's possible is, you know, can you have to start with some causal, you know, mechanistic model of what you think is driving those disorders in order to be able to know how to build some neurological digital twin of how to do that. So I just think there's so much opportunity, but it's very difficult because there's so much variability you need to account for, not just the phenotypic variability related to some disease, but you've also got to account for all of the sources of natural variability, and all of that has to build into one model. And then you're always going to have limited data to model that relative to the amount of data that's available in natural image, for natural image. Yep. Tasks. One way to address that is to add physics informed constraints to your model. But yeah, so absolutely very, very interested in doing this. We've got some early work where a PhD student of mine, Mariana Da Silva, built a physics informed neural network model of the biomechanics of brain atrophy and healthy aging versus Alzheimer's. And so excited to do more in that area, but I think there's a lot of problems to be solved before you'd be getting into the area of that, like moving in towards clinical translation.
For sure. It seems that perhaps they were well-informed when they chose Alzheimer's as their model to get this started, since you also get more anatomical parameters that you can potentially tap into that give you some sort of ground truth that is easier perhaps or more reliable to get to as opposed to other disorders. Where you wouldn't really know where to start and what parameters to even start with. And that's where my question regarding feature importance and feature selection came from. Because with other disorders that are less anatomically identifiable, we are left with a lot of questions and very few physics-informed models that would help us get to the ground truth to even start building our causal models.
This is the thing. This is why classical methods remain important. You need classical approaches for analyzing populations of data to continue to inform your mechanistic understanding of these diseases. Building a digital twin of a disease, but can you build a digital twin of healthy condition and use that as a normative model?
Yeah.
Of, you know, like from which to look for deviations with patients with complex neuropsychiatric disorders. I mean, it's a fascinating but like intimidating question.
Yes, I agree. Well, thank you very much, Emma. I will not hold you any longer. Thank you for taking the time. And I'm looking forward to your talk at OHPM.